Now, the voices of Bronco Athletics, Bob Beeler and Chris Lewis on Sports Radio 93.1 FM and 1350 AM, The Ticket.
Great to be with you. Great to be with Chris, even though he's at the other end of a phone line or ISDN or Ethernet line in Albuquerque getting set to call Boise State's women's basketball game there. Chris, I don't think we're going to see each other face-to-face, but we'll be talking with each other on Wednesdays throughout the rest of the winter.
Yeah, this is the time of year, right, where we got to kind of see each other passing by. Usually at the beginning of the week and the end of the week, we can do a show in studio. But one of us is traveling, and at least we're covering some pretty good basketball teams, at least it seems like, early in the Mountain West season. Boise State women's hoops 2-0, looking to go 3-0 against another 2-0 team in New Mexico, who's been really good this year. And, of course, you just heard Tom Scott and the Scott Slant talk about the success of Chandler Hutchison and the men's team in their showdown today against New Mexico. So maybe could it be 3-0 for each of these teams?
We will find out. Robert Portnoy, the voice of New Mexico, is going to join us at 2 o'clock today. New Mexico on the men's side has been Boise State's biggest nemesis since joining the Mountain West. College football, we're down to one game left during the season, and it's a game I'm looking forward to immensely. Georgia and Alabama, as a senior, that was the one game, one road trip I wanted to make more than anything else back in 1984, Chris, was to go to Boise State. It can be Boise State. Georgia at Alabama for that game. Georgia ended up winning that game 24-14. Neither team were overly good. They were decent, but not great, not like what we're going to see on Monday night of next week. Georgia comes through with the huge win against Oklahoma. Alabama really didn't seem like they had to do a whole lot to beat Clemson. Their defense just smothered them, and it was a fairly easy, at least what I saw, win for the Tide.
Second SEC championship game, if you will, in Atlanta. Now, I'll get the negative out of the way so I can leave you with the positive, and you can talk about your experience watching Georgia in person at the Rose Bowl. Probably a dream come true for you. But like, as far as championship games go, I think this was the least compelling one that we could have had going into the Final Four. I really do think we're missing a fun storyline in the fact that Baker Mayfield is not playing in the national championship. And I know, like, I picked Georgia. I was, in a way, pulling for Georgia, although it would have been fun to see miserable Bob if Georgia would have lost in heartbreaking fashion. But no, I think Baker Mayfield being in a championship game, his personality, his style of play gives a different element. Plus, you know, Oklahoma is at least in a different part of the country. When you have two regional teams and the games being played in that region, what is exactly the appeal for people who are not exactly into the SEC in that way? Like, even, at least even Clemson, it's still regional, but at least it's a different conference. The ACC is in a lot of different markets, so a lot of people have seen Clemson play their squad, so at least there's at least a little bit more intrigue there. Alabama, Georgia seems a little bit regional to me for a national championship game. If the SEC is your thing, went to an SEC school, so I imagine you're hyped for this game. If you're an SEC guy, this is probably about as good as it gets, but it gives me flashbacks to, what was it, 2011, when it was Alabama and LSU in the championship game, and you couldn't debate the strength of those teams. They were both really good, but there wasn't exactly a big hook for a lot of people who weren't SEC diehards to really get into the game. Plus, the style of play from the teams in 2011 wasn't exactly flashy. And while Georgia does have, you know, a couple of dynamic running backs, I don't think any of these teams are going to be trying to put up 30-plus. Now, Georgia likes the low-scoring games. We know how Alabama likes to play it. So convince me, why is this championship game special?
Well, I thought it would be more compelling than Georgia against Clemson. Clemson, by the way, is closer to Athens than Tuscaloosa is by far. Clemson's about an hour and a half, and Tuscaloosa is probably about 4 hours. But that being beside the point, I think the Smart against Saban, to me, is going to be a fascinating chess match in this game. I think Georgia's running backs against the linebackers of Alabama. I think Georgia's freshman quarterback, who was originally committed to go to Alabama when Kirby Smart was an assistant there, he flipped, ended up coming to Georgia. Georgia trying to win a national championship for the first time since 1980. They've got a group of seniors that came back specifically with this goal in mind. The two running backs both would have been taken last year in the NFL draft. Neither decided to go specifically because they felt they had unfinished business. I'm more intrigued to see how Georgia tackles Alabama, because I think that Mark Richt ended up being the coach that would be getting ushered out when Alabama won the SEC championship in 2012, when Georgia's receiver Chris Conley got tackled on the 5-yard line and the time ran out and Alabama won. I think the Georgia program kind of fell into a malaise after that. And then they decided to fire Rick. They brought Smart in. Georgia had a better recruiting year than Alabama. Now, recruiting and a dollar will get you a soda at the machine. But I think that we could be seeing a changing of the guard of the top dog, if you will, in the SEC if Georgia can come through.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not writing Alabama off no matter what the result of this game. Death taxes and Alabama is going to be in the college football playoff year in and year out, and a factor of deciding the national championship. But you were in, you know, at the Rose Bowl for that game, which was a classic. Like, that has to rank among the better games that you've seen in person. Plus, you have the rooting interest attached to it and the fact that, you know, your team actually won the game, too. So that must have been quite the experience for you.
Best game I've ever seen in person in football. I mean, as far as being there, being a fan at the game, sitting there with nearly 100,000 people, the magnitude of the game, the passion both in the stands and on the field, the momentum that switched back and forth about 4 or 5 times during the game. I did not have a chance to go to the Fiesta Bowl. I was sitting on my couch for the 2007 Fiesta Bowl, sitting on my couch in Massachusetts, you know, rooting just kind of to see Boise State beat Oklahoma. But I was several years removed from getting the job here and, you know, following Boise State seriously. But I would say, if you're asking me some college football games that I've been to, this one and the Cal 5 laterals through the band against Stanford, probably the two most intriguing games that I've watched as a fan ever in person.
Yeah, and I think this one probably a little bit more special.
Sure.
Cal Stanford, you didn't really have a rooting interest as much in that game, did you?
No.
This Georgia game where your emotions were probably there. Probably special, too, because I was around, you know, Christmas, around your birthday time and around your wife's birthday time. So there's probably a lot of different things that made that game special, and the fact that I also think Georgia stole it. And that's the other thing about when your team steals a game, you probably feel a little bit more satisfied than if, you know, they barely held on when they probably at the end could have blown a lead. Now, Georgia kind of came from behind and stole it. And I really do look back on it and think that the conservative play calling for Oklahoma really cost them, especially late in the overtimes. For having the Heisman Trophy winner, I've never seen a play caller protect a quarterback who was as accomplished as Baker Mayfield as what we saw in the two overtimes there. It was almost like they were afraid to have him be the one to move the ball. And I know in the second half, they didn't really have as much success pushing the ball down the field as they did in the first half against Georgia through the passing game. But the fact that in the first OT, the only pass he threw was that little Holgorsen flip to the receiver sweeping across the formation. That's not really a pass. You didn't let Baker Mayfield try to beat you. And as a Georgia fan, if you're trying to have everybody else besides Baker Mayfield beat you, I'm sure you'd sign up for that at the beginning of the game.
Oh, I love that third down call from a Georgia perspective. You're running a light receiver across the field. Is he going to be able to turn up and have any kind of power to move somebody from the line of scrimmage? I don't think so. I was thrilled when I saw that play call. I was also thrilled going back forward. I thought there were several places where Oklahoma missed the boat. I thought the squib kick at the end of the first half was a total missing of the boat for Oklahoma. And what a great play by whoever was for Georgia in the front line on the kickoff to grab the ball, cover it, and just down it. Don't waste any time. And then Georgia to get 9 yards and then get a field goal. That field goal, they don't go to overtime without the record 55-yard field goal. But I also thought Oklahoma blew it with about 25, 30 seconds left. They had a 3rd and 2, and they ended up going deep down the right side. I think at that point you're looking to get a first down, move the chains, and then let Mayfield, you know, have a couple, 2 or 3 more plays to get you into field goal range to try to win the game at the end. I thought Oklahoma got awful conservative in the last 55 seconds, and I thought they maybe were a little too conservative in the rest of the game. There were Oklahoma fans around me, Chris, that thought in the first overtime when they had a 3rd and 1, I think it was at the 16-yard line, that was after that play that they did not get any yardage on that little flip toss with the receiver going to the left side, that thought Oklahoma, even down 3, should have gone for the first down at that point.
So that's the first strike, if you will, against Lincoln Riley, who had a pretty good year there at Oklahoma leading the way. But, you know, Bob Stoops had some pretty good regular seasons until letting the team down in big moments. So, if you will, maybe the first strike. But I'm going to get to I've never been to a Rose Bowl. I've only seen it on TV. The hype has been there. Granddaddy of them all. We get it all. How about, like, was the grass as green as you thought? As the commentators try to tell you across the TV, the picturesque background of the event, all that thing lives up to the hype?
Absolutely. And then the mountains, as the sun gets going behind the press box, the mountains get silhouetted on the side away from the camera. One of the greatest scenes was this big B-2 bomber buzz the stadium before the game, before the national anthem. You want to talk about something that's just absolutely huge. It looked like it was something coming out of Star Wars when it came over the hill. Just, they did everything right. The setting was perfect. I mean, the weather, I mean, you can't argue with 72 degrees at kickoff. And then we didn't need a sweatshirt until we were walking out to the car after the game.
Sounds like a good experience. No negative stories?
The other thing that I think about the Rose Bowl that's special, when you watch it on TV or you're watching it there, it starts out as a day game and finishes as a night game. Where there's
unique,
just something about that. You don't see that often where it starts out completely an afternoon game and then ends as a complete night game. The thing that was tough, there was just a few things that sometimes were a bit, the lines were long on some things. The not that many, you know, the easements, the places to get food, the places to, you know, the stadium was built in 1922. There's not a lot of amenities in there. The concessions are kind of makeshift. The bathrooms are old. I mean, those are the things that they probably would have to spend an awful lot of money to change, are the things that, if you're asking me to pick some negatives, Chris, that'd be about it.
Is there an event now that you haven't gone to that is now on your list? I know the Rose Bowl was one that was up there for you. Is there a new next one?
I think it's one you've been to. I think it's a Final Four for me. I've never been to a Final Four. Okay. So I think that would be the next bucket list kind of thing. Something that I would like to go. I would like to go to the College World Series as well, although I wouldn't put that in the same breath with the Rose Bowl and the Final Four, but I think that would be something special to see as well. Best thing you've been to, Chris, the Final Four?
Yeah, Final Four is near the top. Also, the Big East tournament, their last real Big East tournament for me, and somebody who grew up watching Big East basketball, and went to Syracuse, big Syracuse fan too. Being a part of the last real Big East tournament before the whole thing broke up was pretty unique too. So college basketball, I've been to more probably college basketball events than a lot of other sports, and those have to go near the top of the list.
Chris in Albuquerque today. I'm in the studio. Both Boise State teams playing. New Mexico women there, men here. Later tonight, tips at 7 o'clock for both. You can hit Dave and Buster's for the football playoffs and register to win a 3-day, 2-night staycation at the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas. Watch every game you can at Dave and Buster's this playoff season and register your name to win. You must be present on Sunday, February 4th for the big game to win. You'll enjoy a 3-day, 2-night stay at the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino, a $300 credit at the exclusive MB Steakhouse, and a pair of VIP concert passes at the joint, all of that at the Hard Rock. CJP, he'll be there Saturday at 2:30 for Tennessee and Kansas City. Up next, Central Florida is claiming they should be the national champs. Do you agree? Does Chris agree? Do I agree? That's next on Sports Radio, The Ticket. Central Florida had an unbeaten season, capped it off with a win in the Peach Bowl over Auburn. Tremendous season for the Golden Knights. They, though, want to claim themselves as national champs. They're putting it on a banner. They're having a parade. There have been a lot of teams, Chris, in my opinion, that have been non-Power Fives. Boise State twice, that have come undefeated in the last, say, 10, 15 years. And I don't remember any of them trying to claim a national championship. I think Central Florida's reaching a little bit too far. I have no problem with the parade. I have no problem with the banner, but I think I'd entitle mine unbeaten and unrecognized. I'm not going to go as far to put national championship on the banner.
Oh, I like your slogan-making skills right there. Unbeaten and unrecognized. That is a nice rallying cry, and that also can, like, bleed into the next season, too. although, you know, new coaching staff and everything that goes along with that at UCF. So who's to think that next year will be anywhere near as successful as this year? But like, I'm with them. Like, I can kind of understand their beef and what they're doing here. Brand yourself national champions. Why not? Nobody can tell you any different. You didn't get the opportunity to play some of the better teams. The Final Four, of course, you didn't get a chance to play in the playoff, and you won your one bowl game that you had the opportunity against Auburn. And in that game, it's not like this was a thing where Auburn didn't show up. I don't know how much you got to consume of that game, but it looked like Auburn was there. It looked like Auburn to me. It just looked like UCF on the same field was competitive. They weren't, it didn't seem to me like Auburn was significantly faster. The line of scrimmage didn't seem like there was a significant advantage either way. I mean, Auburn made some plays the line of scrimmage, but, you know, UCF didn't look like they didn't belong on the same field by any stretch, and it resulted in that, you know, 34-27 win in that. So I understand kind of what they're doing, and you want to tweak the system or at least jab at it that you didn't have the opportunity to call yourself champions by the traditional college football playoff way, so you could do it yourself. And I have really no problem with that. And I hear a lot of kind of outrage from college football fans because, you know, you didn't play anybody, or, you know, you weren't in the playoff just because you beat Auburn in a bowl game. You're not the only Group of Five team that's ever done what UCF has done before. But hey, if they want to call themselves champions in a flawed system and highlight the fact that the system is flawed and there's still ways to improve it, hey, I'm kind of with them. I'm kind of rocking with the Group of Five representative in UCF and almost embracing them more than I'm pushing them away as a Boise State fan. I think it's better when UCF makes claims like this and boast about the fact that a Group of Five team is doing big things than they would be kind of hiding behind it or just saying, the system's fine and we'll just take our win and we'll be satisfied with it and move on to next year. No, make some noise. Be loud. Be obnoxious about it.
My biggest problem with the way things went down was, if you're not four, I guess it really doesn't matter whether you're five or you're 12, because you're going to get, as long as you're the top-rated Group of Five, you're going to make the New Year's Six bowl game. I don't see how coming into the end of the season, how Central Florida could have been number 12. That's the That's the one thing that really got me. You know, I think you maybe could have made a case that they should have been number four. I mean, they were undefeated. Alabama did not win their league championship. Now everybody says, well, they didn't win a division. They kind of technically did because they tied for the division, but because they lost the tiebreaker to Auburn, Auburn got to go to Atlanta, and they played for the SEC championship. So Alabama lost one game. The record was the same as Auburn's on the west side. It was the same as Georgia on the east side as well. But I think the biggest problem is these people, how they're rating them. If Central Florida turns in a perfect season and can only get to 12. Now, mind you, they did not beat a Power 5 during the regular season. They had one on the schedule against Georgia Tech, who was not a bowl team, who got that game got wiped out because of a hurricane. If they had had one Power 5 win on there against, say, somebody that would be above the midway point in their conference, you wonder how different they might have been looked at. Like next season, if Boise State with a lot back can run the table and wins a game in Stillwater. Now, I don't think Oklahoma State is going to be as good as they were this year. But let's say Oklahoma State goes 8-4 and comes in, say, third or fourth in the Big 12. Would one win against somebody like that be enough maybe to get yourself a little more consideration for the fourth spot?
Well, I think that's why this result is meaningful in a way that UCF won it. This is, you know, another example, and it's not just the only one, and that's the whole thing about, like, Group of Five teams, when they get the opportunity on this stage, they've generally handled themselves well. Mm-hmm. Like, there is a number of examples of Group of Five teams now at this point that have won their game against a Power Conference team in a New Year's Six Bowl, like, or a BCS Bowl. There's now a good sample size of teams that have done it, but the more it gets done, at least maybe it's recency bias and the fact that it's happened, or it happened just about a week or less than a week ago. And by the time we get to September, maybe we'll forget all about it and it'll go back to the status quo of Power Conference teams or bust. But maybe, again, I'm just getting caught up here, but having a UCF run a perfect season and get a win in a big time spot like that and then claim themselves as national champions, down the line could help Boise State when they're in this position, if they ever get to the point where they're undefeated at the end of the year. Can they look back, or will people look back and say, hey, UCF just last year or just 2 years ago or just 3 years ago had a perfect season, and we denied them the chance, and looking back on it, they won their bowl game against a good Auburn team. Maybe we should give this Boise State squad a little bit more consideration for a top four. I think that is not an unreasonable outcome based on this game.
The way the list is set up with the Power Five, five conferences, for somebody that's not a Power Five, and this year was a weird year because one conference for the first time got two teams in. It almost has to happen where two conferences have a lot of rock, scissors, paper, and the champion ends up with two losses or more in more than one conference. Basically play themselves out of the way. You also need a Notre Dame team that's not one loss or fewer, which happened this year. This was a year, I think, that was somewhat there to be taken for a group of five team to make their way in there. And it's really too bad that Central Florida didn't have a little bit bigger resume to try to make the case. But again, I can't believe the committee throughout the entire, you know, polling, when they brought the polls out starting about Halloween, you know, really showed nothing. I mean, the difference between, you know, Boise State and Central Florida, considering Central Florida was undefeated and Boise State had lost two losses, to me didn't seem as great as maybe it should have been. Central Florida.
Yeah, I think most sports fans should have a problem fundamentally with the fact that a team could win every game in a season and not win a championship, right? Like, that should be a fundamental issue with a sports fan. Right? Because sports fans are all in this for the wins and the losses. Mm-hmm. And if you're able to win all of your games in a given season, and again, Boise State fans have been here, so this isn't anything that they're unfamiliar with by any stretch. I feel like you have to have an opportunity to play for some kind of a championship, or else your sport, your playoff system, in some way or the other, is flawed. In every other sport, even if you played a weak schedule, it'll eventually go to the point where you play teams that are good enough to where if you beat those teams, you will be considered champions. Only in college football, at the FBS level, is it to where if you win all your games, there's still an opportunity where you won't be considered a champion.
Well, it'll never happen. It's pie in the sky, Chris, until there's enough playoff games that allow the winner of every conference at the FBS level to make the tournament. Because let's say that the most likely expansion of the playoff system would be to go to eight. Would you agree? That's the most likely, or maybe six. But if you're going to include a group of five, you're going to have to go to eight. And you're going to say every champion in the Power Five gets in. That's five. The best group of five team, which is what's getting in the New Year's Six now, that would be six. And there would be two wild cards. Alabama would have claimed one of the wild cards this year, probably under that scenario. Wisconsin, would you think, would have gotten the other?
Yeah.
Okay.
Be.
All right. USC gets in. Ohio State gets in as league champions. Alabama and Wisconsin are your two wild cards. So there's eight teams in there. What happens if, say, Boise State was also undefeated or Toledo was undefeated? Under that circumstance, whoever the second non-Power 5 champion that's undefeated, they're going to be competing for one of the two at-large spots against Alabama and Wisconsin. So unless you have a system with maybe taking it to 16, which I don't think is practical at all, that would extend the season way too long. I think you can make a case to trim the FCS playoffs back from their 24 or whatever it is now to 16. They've got way too many teams in that playoff. I think that you're never going to have a true champion because there's always that chance for somebody to go undefeated and not get invited.
Unless you have a group of five champion chip game somehow, some way. You squeeze it in.
How many games are you going to play, Chris? How many games?
You're now increasing the game total to the point where, you know, in college athletics, you get concerned because you're not getting compensated any more money for playing these additional games.
Well, how many games are you going to play? You want to play 20 games, 20 weeks in a row?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, eventually, you probably are playing too many games right now as it is for the compensation that they're getting. And if you keep adding on games and not increasing the compensation, now you're all of a sudden running into a problem. So, yeah, I feel you on that. You're going to run into scheduling too many games. And you're not going to have enough conference games because or you have to eliminate one of your weaker non-conference games to squeeze in a group of five championship. But I don't. The solution's hard. It's difficult. It can be done. But in a sport that makes so much money, maybe it's not a problem. But the sports fan in me still can't really get behind the fact that you can win all your games in a season and still not have a chance at claiming yourself to be champions. So that's why I don't blame UCF for calling themselves champions, because you won all your games. You did all you could do.
I don't blame them, but you weren't the national champion. I like my slogan better, unbeaten and unrecognized. The NFL playoffs and Super Bowl are always on Sports Radio The Ticket. Tune in Saturday at 2:30 as the Titans will visit Kansas City to clash with the Chiefs. And that'll be followed by the Rams hosting the Falcons at 6:15. Sunday wildcard weekend continues at 11 a.m. with the Bills at Jacksonville, and at 2:45, Carolina will take on Fish's Saints. If you're listening to the NFL playoffs and the Super Bowl, you'll be listening to Sports Radio 93.1 FM and 1350 AM The Ticket. Up next in the sports update, what's up next for Boise State's men's basketball team? It's up tonight. You can hear it on Sports Radio The Ticket. We'll discuss a little bit of that next on Sports Radio The Ticket.
Ticket Sports Update sponsored by Big Judd's. What's better than Twinkies and pickles? Big Judd's deep-fried Twinkies and pickles. Try the deep-fried goodness of Meridian on Overland and Eagle Road and near Boise State and Protest Hill. Both Boise State basketball teams will be in action tonight. The men's and women's will both take on New Mexico, both looking to go to 3-0 in conference play. The men will be at home in Taco Bell Arena at 7 p.m. And the voice of the Lobos, Robert Portnoy, will join us today at 2 p.m. And on the men's side, the two other undefeated teams in the Mountain West, Wyoming and Nevada, will also be playing each other tonight. So there'll be two teams left after, or at least one team left after tonight. We hope two teams left.
Well, Nevada is the only other team that's 2-0. Wyoming had a bye already on Saturday, so we're getting down to the quickly getting rid of unbeaten teams. Chris, in all of college basketball over the weekend, the final three all got beat with tough road games. I think the Indiana record from 76, winning a national championship with an unbeaten record when Kentucky did it 2 years ago, I think is as close as we're ever going to see. I think winning every single game in the college basketball season, to me, would be unheard of.
It's tough. The talent gap is not there anymore between the top teams and the middle of the pack in college hoops. If you just watch on a nightly basis, like even yesterday, you know, Kansas got beat at Allen Fieldhouse to Texas Tech. And I know Texas Tech is a pretty good team this year, but, like, that's still a shock to see. Like, they had never won before at Allen Fieldhouse. So to see them already lose twice at home, and Kansas still has a lot of talent. But the thing about it is the teams that are typically, you know, pretty good and the most talented are typically also younger teams. The squads that are more experienced may not have a lot of the five-star, the one-and-done type talent. So it's really the difference between how you want to build up your program. You want to be like Villanova, who has very few of the one-and-dones, and they have a lot more juniors and seniors on their team, and they seem like they have success with it that way. But it's still hard to win all your games throughout a season that way. Or are you more like Duke or Kentucky, where your players are there for only 1 or 2 years, and you keep having to recycle it? But the players that you do have are amongst the most talented in college hoops.
When we talk about the college football playoff, we got a text from Darren in CUNA. He said the draw for the Bama-Georgia game is simple. He loves to hate Bama.
I think the neutrals, Chris, are going to be for the Dogs.
Yeah, I would agree. Nobody likes Alabama. Alabama typically. Not only like are they always at the, you know, championship level, like, you know, Golden State nowadays always in the championship. The Yankees back in the day always in the championship. Alabama's that. But Alabama doesn't give you fun games when they're there. Like, at least some of the other teams, like, you know, Warriors play unique style. The Yankees have their, you know, Derek Jeter and all the other big names in baseball, Roger Clemens, everybody who was anybody seemed to be on the Yankees. Alabama's not like that. It's a bunch of nameless, faceless guys, and then Nick Saban on the sidelines and his stubbornness. Nothing really appealing about it.
Well, another reason to hate Alabama, speaking of Nick Saban, is the fact that he always seems to find a way to complain. Despite a 24-6 win over Clemson, they're shot at their fifth national championship in 9 years. Nick Saban is upset about the college football playoff schedule. Said that the Crimson Tide were forced to spend Monday night in New Orleans after the team could not finish packing till 1 a.m., and Saban said he would like to see an extra day of rest to compensate the lost day of travel between the semifinal and the national championship.
Wah! And I'm going to say this as a Georgia person. Georgia had to come all the way back from the West Coast. I'll bet you the lost time not any different than what Georgia had coming from the West Coast. Georgia did leave after the Rose Bowl. They got in very early in the morning, but I can't believe they would have done a whole lot on Monday. You know the game. It's like a regular season game. So why don't we ask Nick Saban to play that Thursday night game like Boise State had to turn around and play New Mexico after coming off the Washington State game. Chris, what do you think? Alabama have to play a Thursday night on short rest. You want to see it?
Yeah, I mean, hey, I'm all for it. Alabama, be at a disadvantage. But no, I find the experience, the quote that Saban had, he said, like, look out for the student athletes, would be a little bit disingenuous. I mean, they're not, as far as I know, Alabama and Georgia, are either of those students in class right now? Or is it still a semester break? So
I don't know, to be honest.
Yeah, if it is semester break, just like a lot of the schools are, I mean, I guess you have more free time now than you typically would during the season. And we know from Boise State standpoint, you have to overcome a lot of adverse situations when it comes to travel and road games and short weeks and things along those lines. And you have to overcome them in big games, and you hope to win those big games. I do say, I will say, one thing I don't like about the national championship game for college football is that it's on that Monday. Because I really feel like the build-up for the game lags because of the fact that the NFL playoffs begin on the Saturday and Sunday. And then on that Monday is the reaction Monday for the NFL wildcard weekend. To the point where I almost feel like the national championship for college football gets placed on the back burner. If you move that game to Wednesday, is there anything that gets in the way from making that like a couple of days later so it gets its own days of hype before it?
Not a bad idea. Georgia in class starting tomorrow, Chris.
Okay.
And Alabama, I'm trying to see where their class schedule starts for this. They start next week on the 10th. Alabama not in school. Georgia in school.
So Nick Saban needs to stop complaining. You got the built-in advantage right there. Built-in advantage on the academic calendar.
No one also, I don't think Saban mentioned the fact that he's the only team of the four that got to sit out conference championship week. They got
too,
an extra
man.
Week off to the semifinal. They didn't know who they were going to play, but they did get an extra week off.
They didn't even know they were in the conference champ. No, they didn't even know they were in the final four.
They didn't know they were in the playoff, but they had an extra week
off. They did have an extra week off. Georgia had to play, and so did
Oklahoma,
Clemson,
and so did Oklahoma. Yeah. So, but I'm sure that glossed over Saban's thing. But speaking of things to watch, last night, former Boise State basketball player James Webb III and the Delaware's 87ers celebrated Nickelodeon Night with SpongeBob SquarePants-themed uniforms. They had a yellow top, then the bottom tie and pants of SpongeBob. Unfortunately, it did not help. The 87ers lost their third game in a row, dropped to 6-15. When will this promotion come to the Philadelphia 76ers, Chris, so I have a reason to watch their basketball?
So you have a reason to watch their basketball? Have you ever heard of Joel Embiid?
Yeah, are you telling me you don't want to see Joel Embiid in a SpongeBob uniform?
I would like to see him in any uniform, although, you know, staying healthy for the long term is the biggest priority with him. It's interesting, I guess, to wear a SpongeBob jersey, but it's very minor league. I don't want to see any professional league stoop to the SpongeBob SquarePants jerseys. Minor league baseball has all these different kinds of jerseys that are auctioned off, typically for great causes, after the game. So I love the minor league aspect of the unique theme nights. When you get to the pro sports, stick with your typical jerseys. If you want to go outside the box and have them alternate, I'm down for it. But you don't have to start naming it after cartoon characters. And when's the last time any of y'all watched SpongeBob? Bob, have you ever watched SpongeBob? You don't have any
kids. I know who he is. I've seen
pictures. Have you ever seen the show?
I've never seen the show, but I've seen pictures. So, I mean, fish. I know that there's like a starfish in there. Isn't there a starfish character in the thing?
Yep.
And I don't know what else is in there, but I do know those two.
There's like a squid.
I would not be good on that kind of trivia.
I think it's been like 5 years since I've watched it, Chris, to answer your question. I didn't even know it was still on until about 2 days ago.
I was passing through the channels one day and I saw it on, and I was like, I used to watch this mess. It's just real odd. Like, who designed this show? Who designed SpongeBob SquarePants living in a pineapple under the sea? It is just the weirdest thing in the world. But, hey, kids love it. It might be the longest-running cartoon on Nickelodeon at this point.
I would think it has to be. Now, Bob, before we end the sports update, if Boise State announced tomorrow, football, they have a SpongeBob-themed uniform. So it's a yellow top. Where's that rank on the Bob Beeler list of jerseys you want to call? We got black, white, blue, orange, and yellow.
Well, I'd have to ask what color the numbers against the yellow top would be the thing I would be most most interested in. I don't see Boise State wearing any combination of yellow. I'm a big fan of wear your team colors. Don't give me other colors. So that's my thought. Chris, I do agree the minor league basketball. I know the Steelheads have had promotions. I think they've worn like some pink jerseys and some other jerseys they've raised a lot of money for. So I think it's something that is very, very minor league, and I think it has been successful for those teams. The boys.
Go ahead. I was going to say it is with the Chuckers. When I was there, we've had a lot of different kinds of jerseys, and those were some of the highest attended nights. So in a way, like, it does work for minor league sports to help increase the attendance for a given night. But once you start getting the pro sports, you'll need to.
Yeah, I can't believe the Sixers would get, or any NBA or NFL team would get something more just because they were going to wear, you know, maybe if you're going to wear throwbacks to the 1955 championship team or something, maybe you might, but I don't think you're going to get it for some cartoon, uniform look. Boise State basketball team will take on New Mexico tonight. You can hear it right here on Sports Radio, The Ticket. Tune in for Abe Jackson and me, starting with the pregame show at 6:30. Game time will be at 7, live from Taco Bell Arena. Bronco men's hoops versus the Lobos on Sports Radio, The Ticket, again tonight at 6:30. Coming up in Quick Hits, when a coach leaves, there's always a list of possible replacements. Which list interests me the most? That's coming up next on Sports Radio, The Ticket.
Quick Hits with Bob and Chris. Topic number one.
We're having a lot of fun with basketball this season. Both Boise State and men's and women's teams have zoomed to the top of the standings, both 2-0 to start. Women's basketball in Albuquerque tonight. You can hear it at 7 o'clock with my broadcast partner, Chris Lewis, over on AM 1350. Sounds like a big challenge tonight, Chris.
Yeah, New Mexico's 14-1, and the Pit is one of the tougher places to play for women's basketball. As tough as it is for men's hoops, it might be more difficult for women's basketball because, you know, crowd relative to the rest of the arenas you go to. New Mexico does pack that place, especially when they're good, and have a second-year head coach who's brought a lot of excitement to the Lobos and an exciting style of basketball, the dribble drive. They have a point guard who's pretty big, gets inside the lane, surround them with a bunch of shooters. That's why they're 14-1, have an RPI. It right now comes in 23rd. They're receiving votes in the AP poll to the point where they're 30th in the country. They beat a ranked team this year at home. They beat Marquette, who was number 16 at the time, 88-87. They beat another unbeaten at the time in Navy when they were both 10-0 to move to an 11-0. So New Mexico has some really good wins this year. So it's a tough task for Boise State to expect this young team to go on the road and get their second road Mountain West win. But again, they went to Colorado State, Moby Arena, last week. The Rams had only lost one conference game the last couple of seasons, and that was to Boise State in their building, and the Broncos beat them again. So you never know what to expect from Coach Presnell's unit. But New Mexico will certainly be the toughest test that they've had to this point this year.
Whenever I see somebody with something and one as a record, my question is, who's the one? Who beat him?
It was Oklahoma by like 40 points. It wasn't really close.
Topic number two.
All right, with Rich Rodriguez being fired at Arizona, what was the first thing that came to your mind?
Well, Murph and I had a topic one day on the show. He was the host in 2012. When Rich Rodriguez was hired, he was hired within about a week span at the same time as Jim Mora was hired at UCLA, Todd Graham at Arizona State, and Mike Leach at Washington State. The question of the day that we pontificated was which one of the four would be the most successful. I said Jim Mora at UCLA. The answer is going to be Mike Leach. Mike Leach, one of just four coaches in the Pac-12 that was hired in 2012. They've been there four seasons. It's still going to be coaching. The other three are gone.
Yeah, and it looks like the Rich Rodriguez reason goes beyond just football.
Sure.
Now, the thing about this, it was the first thing that came to your mind, and it's interesting that you phrased it that way. The first thing that came to my mind was the early signing day and how did they let anybody on their recruiting list know that this was a possibility? Because what I read was that these allegations were made a lot earlier, and they maybe knew before the bowl game, regardless of the result, that Rich Rodriguez might not be there right after the bowl game. They would get rid of him. So the fact that they did, but they did it after the early signing period, are all these kids that joined Arizona because of the coaching staff? What are they feeling at this point? Like, that's Well, I never was a big fan of the early signing period. I don't think it is advantageous for the incoming students. I hope that they picked Arizona based on all the other reasons except coaching staff. And, hey, maybe the coaching staff remains largely the same because they just hire somebody on the staff and they can keep everything together there with Arizona. But that was the first thing that came to mind was the early signing period and how it might not be the best of things.
Topic number three.
All right, Chris, what NFL coach doesn't seem to get any respect?
Jim Caldwell, to me, is the most maybe successful coach that nobody deems to be successful whatsoever. He got fired from Detroit, so now they have a coaching opening. I'm looking at his resume with the Lions. Four seasons, from 2014 to 2017. 11-5 his first year, 7-9 his second year, 9-7 last year, which included a playoff spot, and 9-7 this past season with the Detroit Lions. That's 11-5, 9-7, 9-7 in three of the 4 years. And the other year, it wasn't like a travesty. It was 7-9. Never finished in last place in the division. And they're the Detroit Lions. Like, it's not like this is a franchise that has had, you know, successful seasons one after another before Jim Caldwell. No, it was just a few years prior that they were winless. And you're getting rid of him after having a stint where you're 36-28 in 4 years with the Lions in a division that has Aaron Rodgers. So you're probably not going to ever be the best team in the division because there's one of the best quarterbacks of all time in your division. And then with the Colts, he was 14-2 his first year there, undefeated up until the last couple of weeks of the year when he decided to sit the starters because he thought the playoffs were more important. And what did he do? He got to the Super Bowl with that Colts team. And then he followed that up with 10-6. That's not bad. And then the year after that was the year Peyton Manning got hurt. So, of course, you're going to finish 2-14 when Peyton Manning's not there. And they fired him after that. So he is 62-50 in his coaching career in seven seasons. But he hasn't lasted at a place longer than 4 years. Why do people hate him? Does he not attend the company Christmas parties or something? Why do people hate him?
I'm going to give you this one. From 2000 to 2013, that's 14 years before the Lions hired Caldwell. How many playoffs do you think they made in 14 years? From 2000 to before they hired him?
They maybe one.
One is correct. Lions are a hideous organization. He did deserve a better shake.
Topic number four.
I just don't get it. That one. He's way too successful to be treated the way he's been treated. Normally, when a coach leaves, a list circulates of possible replacements. What list are you most interested in?
Well, Awful Announcing had a list of possible replacements should John Gruden go to the Raiders for the Monday night color commentary spot opposite Sean McDonough on ESPN. They gave five names. They gave Ron Jaworski, saying that he's still on ESPN's payroll. He was part of a three-man crew with the play-by-play and Gruden, and then it was just Gruden. They nudged Jaworski out. He does a good job, but probably wouldn't have the appeal having played in the 70s and early 80s. Chuck Pagano's name was on the list, the recently fired coach at Indianapolis. Not sure. I haven't seen him enough to know if I have a feel of whether he'd be good. Brock Huert's name was mentioned. He's done some Boise State games on television, former Washington quarterback. And then two of the most interesting names, whether they'd be good or not, is another question. Tim Tebow was listed, and so was Peyton Manning.
Peyton Manning. He has to be the number one choice, especially after the success of Tony Romo. Peyton Manning. He's like, I could do everything Romo does. You see me at the line of scrimmage. So I think if ESPN needs to hire somebody, I'm going to guess Peyton Manning will be near the top of their list and they're going to do everything they can. Now, will Peyton Manning want to do it is another question. I want to talk about the John Gruden angle. I know we have only a few seconds here to delve into it. But what if I told you that Jim Caldwell had a better record with the Lions than John Gruden had with the Bucks?
But John Gruden's been on television, and when you're on television, you seem smarter.
That's the thing. Like, John Gruden isn't no prize when it comes to a coaching resume, but somehow he became the hot guy because he's on Monday Night Football, and he's not even like necessarily being the most insightful guy when he's on Monday Night Football.
Monday Night Football and one Super Bowl win. Up next, Boise State men's basketball goes for 3-0 in the Mountain West against the nemesis New Mexico. We'll find out what the Lobos have in store this year for the Broncos next on Sports Radio The Ticket. Basketball season is here. When Christmas finishes, you get to conference play. And this is where everybody, Chris, really starts to focus in on basketball. Over 7,500 in attendance last Wednesday night when Boise State opened Mountain West play with Colorado State, and another tough one tonight against the University of New Mexico.
Yeah, Boise State and New Mexico, they've had some fun games over the past few years, no doubt. And the Lobos, looking at the stats this year, one of the things I'm looking forward to hearing from Robert Portnoy is, why is this team shooting a lot of threes this year? And the record isn't the strongest, and I know with a first-year head coach, you're going to have some things to work out. But what exactly is it that is making them take as many three-pointers as they're taking this year?
So Robert joins us. Robert Portnoy, voice of the New Mexico Lobos. We'll start with that question from Chris. 6-9 this year, 1-1 in the conference. New coach Paul Weir. Is that his philosophy? Is that what the talent bears for New Mexico this year? It seems like it's been much more perimeter-oriented.
Yeah, it's good to be with you, Bob. And the answer to that is yes and yes. He definitely feels like this is the best way for his team to win this year. But it is also part of an overall, you know, cultural sea change, really, in terms of the philosophy for New Mexico basketball moving forward. He's a strong believer in the three. He hates two-point jump shots. He wants to shoot a layup or knock down a three. And that's what this team has tried to do. The funny part of it is, Bob, that they haven't been a very good two-point field goal shooting team, and when you're taking most of your twos around the basket, it doesn't speak very well for your ability to finish at the rim, and it actually has been kind of a recurring problem. They've been a more effective team from three, really, than they have been from two. The only two-point shot that he really likes is a wide-open, uncontested mid-range shot. You can find your way to the bench in a big hurry if you take contested twos on this team.
But that's not a very unusual strategy at this point, especially if you look at all levels of basketball, threes or layups. It's almost Daryl Morey style of basketball, and it's the new age of it. But how does their personnel fit that style of play?
Pretty much everybody can shoot the three. I mean, you know, everywhere we go, I'm asked, so who are the three-point shooters? Who are the guys that I have to watch? And I said, well, if their name isn't Joe Furstinger, you probably need to pay attention to him. I mean, literally, a couple of the bigs, Joe has even made one this year. But if he shoots a three, or if Vladimir Pinchuk shoots a three, then you've got a story. But everybody else has a full-on green light to shoot the three-point shot, and they're all pretty good at it. So the Lobos, when they're shooting it well, they can be a handful.
Lobos have beaten Boise State four times in a row. That means sweeps in each of the last 2 years. New Mexico leads the series 10-3, Boise State's poorest record against anybody since entering the Mountain West. But this New Mexico team, Robert, very, very different from last year. Coach Craig Neal is gone. As we mentioned, Paul Weir up the road from Las Cruces takes over. Elijah Brown, Tim Williams, Obach Ajet all graduated or transferred. And this team has got a lot of new faces, and it looks like they've used a whole bunch of different players. So talk about what we might see tonight. I'm trying to put together my chart, and I can't figure out who's supposed to start or how many minutes people are supposed to play.
So you can expect 10 or 11 for sure. That's guaranteed. They all will play, and they all will get at least 10 minutes. That's a big part of Coach Weir's philosophy. He feels with the style that the Lobos play, that playing 11 guys is a way to wear down the opponent, especially against teams like a Nevada the last go-around, and even to a lesser extent Boise, who don't go on their bench. His idea is that by the time you get to that final 7-8 minutes of the game, that the opposition is tired, they miss some of their free throws, the Lobos' pressure and intensity and pace starts to catch up with them, and they make mistakes. We've seen it happen. It hasn't translated into wins against the better teams on the Lobos' schedule so far, but the philosophy is pretty sound. He doesn't quite have the horses just yet to really be as good a pressing team as he wants to be. That's the way that he's taking this program. Now, here's the interesting thing regarding the starting lineup. I don't even know who's going to start. The Lobos have a stat called deflections. It's not just the number of passing lanes that you get into and balls that you bat out of bounds. It has everything to do with all those hustle stats that you think of, diving on the floor for loose balls, converting steals. It does include deflections of passes that generate turnovers, things like that. Or even just stoppages in play and knocking the ball out of bounds. Every game, those are totaled by the Lobo staff. The guys who start the next game are the five guys who had the most deflections per minute on the court. It has nothing to do with totals. It has to do with effort and intensity for the minutes that you're out there. And you'll find that the second half starting lineup might not duplicate the first half starting lineup. That's because the deflections are totaled at halftime, and the guys who did it the most in the first half will start the second.
Wow, that is very unique. I've never heard of anything like that. Like where did he develop that philosophy? Where did that come from?
I've done it from the start of the year. It's something that he implemented when the Lobos were on the road against Colorado back in early December. He realized that, you know, to get his guys to commit to the defensive side of things, which is going to be the foundation for his program moving forward, that he had to figure out a way to motivate them. And he decided the one thing that mattered to them, or one of the things that mattered to them most, if not the most, was starting. And so he said, if you guys want to start, you're going to play defense. And from that point forward, that's what it's been. And what is that now? 6 or 7 games now that this has been the case. He didn't like the commitment on the defensive side of the ball through the season's first month. And he was darn well sure that he was going to get his guys commit to it at the start of December.
New Mexico is 6-9 on the season, 1-1 in the Mountain West. They've beaten Air Force easily at home and lost by 3 to Nevada on the road. Robert Portnoy, the voice of the Lobos, joining us. Robert, that was the score, even though you guys did not win, that made me open my eyes and say, you know what, maybe this New Mexico team is improving as the year's gone along. I know you guys have not had a win away from the pit, but to go to Nevada, arguably the top favorite heading into the conference season, and play them to a 3-point game, must say that the team's improving.
Yeah, it opened our eyes too, Bob. There's no doubt about it. It kind of started really, I feel like, with that road trip to Boulder to take on the Pac-12's Colorado Buffaloes. But games at home against New Mexico State and Arizona back-to-back weeks were outstanding efforts on the part of UNM. The score against Arizona is not indicative of how competitive that game was when the Wildcats came in ranked 23rd in the country. New Mexico had a chance to tie New Mexico State at the finish at home after being blown out by them by double digits in the season's first month on the road. And they're a favorite, you know, in the WAC again. So you look at what they've done here, what the Lobos have done in the month of December, and yes, it is trending upward, there's no doubt. And the way that they competed at the Lawler Events Center was really impressive. And, you know, they had it tied at 70 with under 5 minutes remaining in the game. They were again within 2 points with under a minute left in the game. Nevada got a free throw to make it a 3-point margin, and the Lobos just could not get a quality shot off on 2 inbounds plays in the final possession of the game where they had a chance to tie. But, yeah, I think that the way that they rallied, because they got down double digits against Nevada, and certainly that's a place where against that team you could have packed it in and the tent could have folded, but it didn't happen. You'll find that this team's really resilient. The Lobos will not back down, even though that they might not have the size to match up with some of the teams across the, you know, the landscape of the conference this year. But this team will not be out-hustled. It will not be out-efforted. Their intensity is really fun to watch.
Robert Portnoy, voice of New Mexico, joining us here on Idaho Sports Talk on Sports Radio, The Ticket. And just from hearing your description of the Lobos, it almost to me seems like the definition of a team you don't want to play in a single elimination format. They shoot threes, the press, the high tempo, the deflections and all that. It seems like their games will be high variance, where sometimes they'll be hitting the threes and they could beat anybody. But with that style of play, perhaps maybe they can get some L's that you wouldn't expect on the schedule. Is that the kind of read? Am I getting the correct read on the team from that?
Well, it's funny, Chris, that you mentioned a single elimination format, because what Coach Weir has said, and he said it again recently to me, was that, you know, the design for this year is all set up for those 3 or 4 games in March. I kind of like to take both a micro and a macro view of the Lobos this year. The micro view is within a single game, what they're trying to do with their pressure defense and their intensity and playing 11 guys is wear you down over the course of 40 minutes to the point where they gain an advantage at the finish. And they just want to try to make it a 5-minute game if they can against teams that have superior talent. The macro view of it would be a season-long view where the same thing is being attempted, where the Lobos would be the exact opposite of a team like Nevada, as the number one example, that really only plays about 7 guys. And, you know, 5 of those guys are averaging 35 to 38 minutes a game. And the idea is that by the time you get to those 3 or 4 games that you have to win in a row in the Thomas and Mack, that those teams are going to be hobbled. Those teams are going to be worn out. Those teams might even be shorthanded, and those teams might be asking guys who haven't competed all year to do things that are out of their norm by the time you get to the end of the season. Whereas New Mexico regulates the minutes of its top players, gives its bench players tons of minutes and even starts, and everybody's comfortable with the 10 to 15 minutes that they get coming off the bench or the 20 to 25 minutes they might get starting. And by the time you get to March and you get to the Thomas and Mack, the Lobos are the freshest team. The Lobos are the team that is peaking when the other teams are just trying to hang on. So that's kind of the way I view it.
Robert, thanks so much for your time. Always fascinating when we get to conference, especially when you see somebody maybe two or three times. We'll see how they adjust throughout the year, and should be a good one tonight. New Mexico has had Boise State's number more often than not, and we'll see if the Broncos can come through tonight.
Well, we look forward to it, Bob. It's always great being in Boise. Thanks
appreciate
for having
it. And that is Robert Portnoy, the voice of the Lobos. And, Chris, a lot of teams this year have got different things than they've had. I mean, last year this was kind of a two-man show with Brown and Williams, coached by Craig Neal. If you just put blank jerseys on the two teams, last year's Lobos and this year's Lobos, not representative or not, you know, doesn't look at all like what they had last year.
I remember Bairstow and Kirk a few years ago. So it's usually like, you know, that two-man attack from New Mexico, and they kill you with that. Hugh Greenwood, too. It's quite the transition away from the New Mexico that we remember from just a few years ago as a top-two team in this league. But, hey, transitions happen, and this might not be the season, but you can at least tell from Robert Portnoy that they're starting to develop at least some of the characteristics that they want this program to be known for two, three, 4 years from now.
Hit Dave and Buster's for the football playoffs and register to win a three-day, two-night staycation at the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas. Watch every game you can at Dave and Buster's this playoff season and register your name to win. You must be present on Sunday, February 4th for the big game to win. You'll enjoy a three-day, two-night stay at the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino, a $300 credit at the exclusive MB Steakhouse, and a pair of VIP concert passes at the Joint, all at the Hard Rock. CJP Saturday, 2:30 for Tennessee and Kansas City. When we come back, Chris and I will take a closer look at Boise State in the Mountain West playing New Mexico tonight. Joe Lunardi has the Broncos in his latest bracket. What's it going to take to stay there? That's next on Sports Radio The Ticket. Bob and Chris back on Idaho Sports Talk. Chris coming to you from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Women's basketball are there. Men's basketball here tonight at 7 o'clock against New Mexico as well at Taco Bell Arena. And Chris, Boise State off to a tremendous start. They in Nevada have the best resume going right now. Boise State is at 12-2 on the season. Nevada is at 13-3. Both teams are 2-0 in the Mountain West. Joe Lunardi has both of the teams right now in his mock bracket to start. And Boise State, Chris, to me, looks like a team that needs to take care of business. And if they do, could probably find themselves getting in, whether they win the league or not.
All right, yeah, what's taking care of business, though? You have to define that because I'm not exactly sure whether the Mountain West is a bona fide multi-bid league yet. Like, there was still a lot of talk before league play started that it probably wouldn't be a multi-bid league. So is taking care of business winning the regular season?
Yes.
Like, that's a tough ask for taking care of business. Taking care of business is to win the league? That seems like a little bit more than taking care of business.
I think taking care of business for sure is to finish in the top two. I think you've got to finish in the top two to get an at-large. And then if you do that, I think you have to hope that, assuming Nevada is the team that would win the league, I think you would have to hope that they would win the tournament. I think you're going to have to go like 14-4 to get an at-large.
Okay. And New Mexico's the type of team that can mess that up. Like, that's what I learned from that conversation with Robert Portnoy. Now, it could be Boise State. It could be maybe another contender in UNLV if they want to be a contender, or Nevada. We already saw that they had a close three-point win, Nevada, against New Mexico already this season. But I feel like the Lobos are the type of team that could mess up the picture because they're not going to be a contender, right? Like, their style of play is too volatile. Their experience is just not there. Their talent isn't there. They're not going to be a 14-4 type team. They're not going to have only five losses in this league, I don't think. But their best, could it beat a Boise State? Like, that's why I'm a little bit even nervous for the game tonight. The way they play, it seems like, well, it's just going to be a matter of they miss a bunch of their shots, or will they make some of them and be able to hang into the game? Because Boise State, they play that zone, the 2-3 zone. Now, they have played man-to-man stretches too, but they've also played a lot of zone defense this year. And the zone has been pretty effective against a lot of teams. However, good teams can get three-pointers against the zone. If those threes go in, there's really not much you can do about it except break out and then try to scramble man-to-man after that. And if New Mexico gets hot, there might not be much you can do after that. So, like, that's the one thing about, you know, Boise State will do what they do. Hutchinson's going to get into the paint. He's going to be a monster. And if you collapse on him, he's going to find the Boise State shooters. And there's not many teams in the Mountain West that could do much about it. But if New Mexico, they take, what, the 10th most threes in the nation? If they go in, they're scoring three at a time. And it, as talented as Boise State might be, it might be hard to overcome a team that shoots 40% from three-point range with the amount of threes that they take.
All right, let me give you a couple of things for New Mexico. You do say that they shoot 40%. I've got them at shooting 36%.
If in a given game they shoot 40% from three-point range with the volume of threes that they take,
But
that's going to be hard to beat.
Looking at this matchup tonight, the numbers that stick out for the season, New Mexico has not won a game away from the pit, which you could say the do theory, so maybe they'll get one. Colorado State was in the same boat last week. New Mexico is -4 per game rebounding. New Mexico has also given up 46% shooting from the floor and 36% shooting from three. I think defensively all this switching around, yeah, they might have a lot of people that are in there hustling, but I don't know that their defensive numbers show me that this is a team ready to come in here and knock Boise State off.
Yeah, it's fair. Like, I think if this game is played, you know, 10 times, Boise State's going to win more of them. Mm-hmm. Just, will this be one of the, you know, the Houston Rockets style of play? Like, are the Rockets better than the Warriors? No, probably not. But with their style of play, can they win a game against the Warriors that you otherwise wouldn't expect? Yeah, because they shoot enough three-pointers that if they hit a decent amount of them, it might be even regardless of the defense that's played on them, if those threes go in, then they're going to be tough to stop. And New Mexico certainly won't be consistent enough to hit that many threes throughout the 18-game conference season. But in one of those 18 games, can they be unstoppable from three-point range? Yes, and that's what would make me nervous, that it wouldn't – let's hope it's not today that it's the game where New Mexico is able to connect on a bunch of threes. They're 6-9. They're not great. They're not – a very good team. I think Boise State is favored by more than 10 points in this game. So they should take care – the word you use, take care of business. Yeah, they should. But, you know, it's one in an 18-game schedule of basketball. And it's not like Air Force where, you know, like even Air Force, I think their ceiling is a little bit limited for how they, because of the way they play. I think New Mexico has a higher ceiling than a lot of the teams in the Mountain West. If they play their best game, they might be able to beat some of the better teams in the league.
Boise State basketball team again taking on New Mexico, and you can hear it right here on Sports Radio 93.1 FM, The Ticket, tonight. You can tune in. Abe Jackson and I will have the call starting with the pregame show at 6:30. Tip will be at 7 o'clock live from Taco Bell Arena. It's Bronco men's hoops against the Lobos on Sports Radio, The Ticket, tonight at 6:30. I've got to scoot over to interview Coach Leon Rice for our pregame show. Up next in the sports update, Fish is going to talk about, has Derek Jeter officially lost his mind in running Fish's Florida Marlins? That's next on Sports Radio, The Ticket.
Ticket Sports Update sponsored by Big Judd's. What's better than Twinkies and pickles? Big Judd's deep-fried Twinkies and pickles. Try deep-fried goodness in Meridian on Overland and Eagle Road or near Boise State and Protest Hill. And Chris, you had to pick one. What are you going with? Deep-fried Twinkies or deep-fried pickles?
Ooh.
I mean, you're the foodie here, so...
Yeah, I'd probably go with pickles, you know?
What?
I like the saltiness. I'm more of a salty than the sweets. Like, give me chips over cookies for the most part. So I'm usually, you know, gotta have the salt in the snack for it to be really appealing to me.
One day, Chris. We'll work on that. We'll work on it. It's deep-fried Twinkie. I don't even want to look at a deep-fried pickle. But going to the sports update, Derek Jeter's plans to fix the Miami Marlins have gone anywhere but positive. And it's been come out that there's an interesting strategy by Derek Jeter and the ownership group. It's known as Operation Wolverine, which owes back to Derek Jeter coming from Michigan, that the ownership is going to make the Marlins profitable in 2018. Now, part one of that plan included shedding $36 million in payroll by getting rid of Stanton, Ozuna, and Gordon. They did that. The next part is The plan says the team projects paid attendance, which last year was 860,000, will jump up to 1.1 million this year, and that the team will make an estimated $7 million more in ticket revenue. But I don't know who's going to go to the game.
Yeah, who are you going to see? The jump in attendance is going to see who?
Derek Jeter? If he plays, maybe.
Marlins man going to?
I read a report that Marlins man has not renewed his season tickets yet.
Uh-oh. Why does Marlins man have season tickets, though? He's too busy going to all the other teams' games.
Because he's
in NBA final. Why does he have season tickets to the Marlins?
Because he's one of the few fans. That's part of the reason there's so many empty seats.
He's a big event guy. Maybe he's bought the whole stadium and is not showing up to any of the games, so it looks bad. But, that Marlins man is the most famous fan, and he'd rather go to all the other teams' games except Marlins. So what does that say about your squad, Fish? Have you picked a new team, by the way?
Not yet.
What's the deal with this?
No, not yet.
What's the timeline on this? Come on,
I need to wait for the winter meetings to end. I need everything. You know, I need to pick a team that actually has a chance to compete. I don't want my heart broken again. I need to get all my ducks in a row, Chris.
Philadelphia Phillies.
No, down the road. This is like in the NFL where free agency is before the draft. So after a team makes a free agent signing, everyone's excited for that player that was signed to free agency, only to draft someone who replaces that player. And yes, I might be talking about Adrian Peterson.
What are the qualities that you're looking for in the team?
I'm looking for a team that is exciting to watch, has a chance to win a World Series, and will not get rid of all their players after 1 year.
I know a new season of The Bachelor started this weekend, right? Like, a new season of The Bachelor started on. Like, can we have Fish as The Bachelor and he needs to pick a new baseball team?
I think we should do that. All the baseball teams competing for my fandom, whatever that's worth.
Yes. And you can give out roses and stuff?
Yeah, we should do that. I mean, baseball's they're in the lull period anyway. See, I equate this to, you know, a bunch of people like, well, who cares about the Marlins? If you have Boise State, we've had ticket issues. If Cedric Wilson, Leighton Vander Esch, and Brett Rippon all left, and they said, hey, but please, come, more of you are going to come to the games now, right? That's what I equate this to. Who am I going to watch? The kicker?
You might watch the grounds crew. I think the grounds crew might put on a great show for the Marlins, and they might be dancing, and you can watch that. Yeah, I got nothing for you, Fish. I'm sorry. You just should pick the Phillies as your new team and get on with it.
Well, Chris, I might pick the Delaware 87ers. Maybe this is how the Marlins can get people in the stands, because last night they had a promotion. It was Nickelodeon night. James Webb, former basketball player, Boise State, he plays on the 87ers. They wore SpongeBob SquarePants uniforms, which I have to say, if the Marlins wore that, I would go to those. I would stay a fan. That's what you got to do. Good, if you're a bad team, good jerseys. The 87ers understand that. They're 6-15, bad team, good jerseys, still fans in the stands.
When do you think SpongeBob SquarePants started? Like, I'm really going to put up the Wikipedia page. I know you don't have it up, so take a guess. When was the first episode of SpongeBob SquarePants?
I want to say, I'm saying 2003.
1999.
Ooh, part of me said it might have been a late 90s, but even that seems, it's been on the air for almost 20 years?
It's insane. Like, this cartoon, how? How is it this cartoon? Somebody let me know. And somebody out there listening has to have kids. And if they have kids, they're probably in the SpongeBob SquarePants. So at least, like, I was, I guess, when I was a kid. 1999, I was, 8 years old. Like, I was right in line for SpongeBob. Like, that was me. I watched the show. But, like, you know, I haven't watched it in well over 10 years. And I am surprised that this thing is still a thing. They're still coming up with, like, new episodes. How many new storylines can SpongeBob, Patrick, Starfish, I forget the squid's name.
I think it's Squidward.
Can somebody help me
out?
It's
Squidward.
Oh, yeah. There you go. There's a squirrel in this show.
Yeah, there's a squirrel.
I'm looking at the picture right now.
There's a squirrel. There's a crab. There's a whale.
Her name is with an S.
Sandy,
I know there's Mr. Sandy. Sandy, okay. Yeah. There's Mr. Crab.
Yep.
I remember. There's a snail. I forget the snail. I think
it's Gary. It's his pet.
Man, you're good at this.
I watched.
Blowfish is the teacher.
I don't remember her name.
You know the teachers? I think it's Mrs. Puff.
That makes sense. The names are very easy to remember for the most part, I feel like.
There's a big old whale.
Yes.
I don't know the
Which
whale's
is the
name.
Crab's daughter. Which doesn't
Wait,
make
what?
Any sense.
And then the whale become the crab's daughter?
I don't know. It's just been that way since I remember watching.
How is the sponge living in the water, underwater in a pineapple? And why are these Delaware 87ers wearing the jerseys of this? How is it still on when it debuted in 1999? How many shows debuted in 1999 that are still on TV, like, other than Survivor?
SpongeBob. That's, I think it's those two.
Geniuses, though. I'm sure it's making a lot of money. The creators, the everybody associated with it. And the fact that a minor league basketball team is able to wear their jerseys. And I'm sure they're not the first minor league team that's had a SpongeBob SquarePants night. I'm sure it's been a
thing. I don't know. With all the press that's coming out, it makes me really believe this is the first one. I'm starting to believe this is the first one.
I can't believe it's the first one. No, there was a Fresh Prince of Bel-Air night recently at minor league. I forget what team ran it. No, there's not a chance that this is the first minor league SpongeBob SquarePants night. Now, how many can they get the voices of these people to show up at the game and, like, reenact an episode? That would be something very unique. So that's taking it to the next level. Get the voice actors from the show and have them put on a staged episode in front of your home crowd.
Well, speaking of 1999, when the show debuted, Pro Football Hall of Fame announced their 15 finalists. I think most of these guys were playing in 1999. I don't think I would ever have thought that a show started while these guys were playing would still be on the air. But of the 15 finalists, four are first-time finalists, and Ray Lewis, Randy Moss, Steve Hutchinson, and Brian Urlacher. Other finalists include Isaac Bruce, Brian Dawkins, Ty Law, Edgerrin James, and Terrell Owens. My question to you, Chris, will any of those three receivers, Randy Moss, Isaac Bruce, or Terrell Owens, get into the Hall of Fame this year? If so, which one?
T.O. won't. They hate T.O. I don't think T.O.'s getting into no Hall of Fame. That's unfortunate. This T.O. is definitely a Hall of Fame receiver, but nah. Randy Moss better get in, too, because Randy Moss was ridiculous. And if he's not a first ballot Hall of Famer, I don't know who is a first ballot Hall of Fame receiver. Who's the other one?
Isaac Bruce.
See, Isaac Bruce I would put below the other two. He's definitely third in the pecking order for me, although his counting numbers might be even better than... Well, T.O. has a lot of counting numbers. Randy Moss is a little bit lower on the counting stats, but he was just he was the best receiver. He was a game plan changer. So, yeah, Isaac Bruce is a step behind those two.
I agree. Moss, Owens, and Bruce, and the sad thing is it might be Isaac Bruce that gets the nod because he was the least dramatic, should we say.
So why is drama like considered such a negative
I don't
for
know.
Hall of Fame?
I don't know.
Like, it, drama is good.
Yeah, it made me watch
like
the
drama.
Sport.
The media... is the one who's voting on these things. You guys love drama. Media's supposed to love it. That's what keeps people reading. That's what keeps people wanting to come and consume sports talk radio. It's the drama. We love drama. Put dramatic guys in.
Well, speaking of the NFL, one of the few coaches who not only survived Black Monday somehow, but will have a job going forward, I think this might have been the least likely candidate, is the Cincinnati Bengals' Marvin Lewis. About a month ago, it was rumored he was stepping down. The Bengals were going to miss the playoffs. It's about time for a change. Well, yesterday night it was announced that Lewis has signed a 2-year extension through the 2019 season to remain with the Bengals. Did you see this coming, Chris?
No, I thought he was going to step down.
I did too.
I thought he's had enough of the Bengals. Like, the Bengals are too good. Marvin Lewis is too good for the Cincinnati Bengals team. Marvin Lewis still is a very capable coach. For the Bengals, a team that throughout our lifetimes has been just trash, straight garbage. I'm looking at their season by season from 1991, when the year I was born, to 2004. No, let's go to 2003, the year before Marvin Lewis showed up. They didn't have a winning record any of those seasons. So by the time I was born until I turned 14 years old, they didn't have a winning season. And Marvin Lewis showed up. And Marvin Lewis, 8-8, 8-8, 11-5, 8-8. And ever since then, they've been a fringe playoff team. Whether they win in the playoffs, they haven't done that. That's the thing. They haven't won a playoff game. But the Bengals are an organization that is notorious for not investing a lot of money in scouting, being behind the curve when it comes to training and athletic staffs, and not having exactly the greatest in-stadium for player experiences, locker rooms, and all that kind of stuff. At least that's some of the things that have been widely reported. So for a team that just, in an ownership, that doesn't invest a lot of money in some of the other factors that a lot of other teams invest money in when it comes to factors that involve winning, for the Bengals to be winning at a level that is very comparable, if not envious, of a lot of other teams in the sports, I have to think that's a lot to do with the coach. So I think Marvin Lewis is pretty good. And I'm surprised he wanted to stick with the Bengals and their lack of commitment to a lot of the other factors that winning that involve winning that all the other franchises invest a lot more money in.
But you have a ginger quarterback. That's why you stay, right? For Andy Dalton, the Red Rifle.
Nah, I mean, it's not like Andy Dalton is anybody to keep a person around. Is Andy Dalton going to be their quarterback next year? I think that's not a given.
I would think so. Even if they draft a quarterback, you would think it would make sense to sit him down, right? We see what happens when you rush a quarterback in, for the most part. There were some exceptions this year.
Carson Wentz.
Well, he was only 8-8 last year, right? 7-9, 8-8. He didn't have a winning record.
I think it was pretty good for his development, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it was great for Jared Goff, but that might have been a coach. But speaking of the Bengals, Chris, this broke last night, so we get a chance to talk about today. Carson Palmer announced that he is retiring from the NFL, and it just makes me sad because now I'm starting to realize all the quarterbacks that I grew up watching are slowly going to retire. The Peyton Manning's already gone, but the Eli Mannings, the Tom Brady, the Drew Brees, the Phillip Rivers, the Ben Roethlisberger, once they're gone, all my childhood, not heroes, but guys I watch are going to be gone. It kind of makes me sad.
Drew Brees will never retire, though.
No, I think Tom Brady will never retire, Chris.
They're both, you know, pretty still playing at a high level. But yeah, Tom Brady's not going away. Drew Brees, he'll be sticking around for a while. So you don't have to start crying, get your tears out, and get the tissues ready. You don't need to do that just yet.
Perfect. Well, up next, it's what we learned on Idaho Sports Talk. And don't forget, the NFL playoffs and Super Bowl are always on Sports Radio Ticket. Tune in Saturday at 2:30 as the Titans visit the Kansas City Chiefs. Followed by that, the Rams will host the Falcons at 6:15. Sunday Wild Card Weekend continues. 11 a.m., the Bills at the Jacksonville. And at 2:45, Carolina will try and beat the New Orleans Saints after going 0-2 in the regular season. If you're listening to the NFL playoffs and Super Bowl, you are listening to Sports Radio 931 FM and 1350 AM. The Ticket. Up next, what we learned and why New Mexico might be the scariest team to face in the Mountain West postseason tournament. That's up next on Sports Radio The Ticket. And it's time to find out what we learned on Idaho Sports Talk with Bob and Chris. It's brought to you by Prem Sports, your full-service pro shop and bowling specialist. High-quality bowling balls, bags, shoes, and accessories located right inside Westie's Garden Lane in Garden City. Both Boise State men's and women's basketball team is in action tonight. The women on the road. Chris Lewis will be on the call. They're taking on New Mexico, looking to go to 3-0 in conference. How confident are you feeling, Chris, before we get to the men's game on the women's side, that they've 2-0 in conference so far?
I mean, it's a pleasant start. The win at Colorado State, I don't think anybody could really have expected Boise State to go to Moby Arena and beat a Colorado State team that is as accomplished as they are, especially with the up-and-down nature that Boise State women's basketball had in the non-conference, including losing two of their last three, including a loss to Cal State Bakersfield, which I know frustrated the coaching staff quite a bit. But, you know, two different styles of play in the first two Mountain West games and got those victories. New Mexico, though, has been at another level so far this season. They only have one loss, 14-1. Their loss coming to a pretty good Oklahoma team, and Oklahoma blew out New Mexico by about 30 points. Lobos do have a ranked win at home, too, against Marquette. So Boise State is going to have to play their best game of the year, similar to what they played against Washington earlier on this season when they beat the Huskies by 20-plus points. If they're going to want to win this game on the road, and Lobos have beaten the Broncos the last two times in Albuquerque. So let's see if Boise State can reverse it on the women's basketball side. That's not even getting into the men's basketball team and them trying to end their struggles against the Lobos, having lost four in a row.
I was going to say, what you just said about the women have to play maybe their best game of the season to beat the Lobos on the road. It's almost what you'd say about the New Mexico men's team. They've been struggling a little bit this year under new coach Paul Weir. Maybe they have to play their best game to beat Boise State at home. But maybe that's all by design. We talked to Robert Portnoy, the voice of the Lobos, and he said that this team is designed for those 3 days in March in the Mountain West Conference Tournament.
What Coach Weir has said, and he said it again recently to me, was that, you know, the design for this year is all set up for those three or four games in March.
That scares me, Chris. That scares me when you have a team that's like, yeah, we'll kind of ship it into the regular season, but we're going to come at you in March when it really counts.
Yeah, it's really intriguing what Coach Weir is doing, where it's just a bunch of threes. They're, what, top 10 in the nation in three-pointers attempted and three-pointers made. they're going to get those three-point shots up, whether they go in or not. I guess the record kind of tells the story. And their defense has not been great this year. They play a lot of people. So it does profile, though, as that team you don't want to face in a single-game format. They play a lot of people, so they're probably not going to be as worn down as some other teams that have a shorter rotation of just like seven players, a la Nevada, what they like to do. And they have a very talented top seven, but they don't go much deeper than that. They shoot threes. Now, the thing about three-pointers, you can defend threes relatively well and still have them go in. And if they go in, let's say at a 40% clip, and you're shooting as many threes as New Mexico is shooting, if in any game you shoot 40%, that's all of a sudden really tough for you to stop because they're scoring three at a time, and you're going to have to be really good on the other end to offset for that. So, like, this is the one team where you could play a decent game, but if the Lobos play up to their ceiling, that might be hard for a team to overcome in that single-game elimination format. Now, whether they'll play up to that level tonight or whether they'll play up to that level in any one game in March, that is still to be seen. But I do think the Lobos will be one of those squads this year in the conference that you'll look at the scores on any given Wednesday or Saturday in the league and you'll think, whoa, how in the world did that happen? How did New Mexico beat Nevada? How did New Mexico beat UNLV and knock UNLV from being a contender in this league to suddenly firmly in third place? So I do think that's the destiny for the Lobos this year, and then when they start to get the talent the next couple of years, maybe they can take the next step up.
Well, not only are the Lobos going to be difficult because, like you mentioned, they're a three-point shooting team, we also got to talk to Robert Portnoy, and the fact that the starting lineup for the Lobos, not even their own play-by-play guy knows, because they have quite the interesting stat to determine who gets to start on any given night.
Here's the interesting thing regarding the starting lineup. I don't even know who's going to start. The Lobos have a stat called deflections. It's not just the number of passing lanes that you get into and balls that you bat out of bounds. It has everything to do with all those hustle stats that you think of, diving on the floor for loose balls, converting steals. It does include deflections of passes that generate turnovers, things like that, or even just stoppages in play and knocking the ball out of bounds. Every game, those are totaled by the Lobo staff. The guys who start the next game are the five guys who had the most deflections per minute on the court.
So that just screams scary to me when you know that this is going to be a team that they know the next game who plays is determined by how hard they hustle. You never want to play a team that is overly motivated to get non-traditional basketball stats that result in turnovers.
They're going to be a little scrappy?
Yeah.
They're going to be a little chippy?
I don't know if chippy's the right word. I don't know if chippy counts for the deflection stat, but scrappy definitely. There'll be some loose ball dives, maybe a couple guys flying into the scorer's table. If you're courtside tonight at Taco Bell Arena, you might want to be careful because I'm sure there'll be three Lobos flying into the stands because they want to start the next game.
I don't know if that's necessarily, though, the best way to go about it for basketball. Like, I don't know. Like, that changing your starting lineup every game, there's something to be said for lineup continuity, you know, chemistry, knowing where your guys are. That's the thing about the NBA. I follow it really closely. The teams that are usually good in the regular season are lineups that have been together for long periods of time because they turn the ball over less frequently. They know where each other likes the ball. They get into their sets a lot better. Teams that are new coming together, they typically take a little bit longer to gel. Because there is something to be said for lineup continuity. If you're starting a different starting lineup every game based on a stat from the previous game, I don't know how exactly you're supposed to develop a rhythm for an offense. Like, I know they just like to shoot threes, and that's been their thing this year. But are you really developing the team in the best way possible if this is how you're determining who starts every game? Like, I don't know if I would like to play on that team. I don't know if that's the way I would like to be managed.
So, you know, I think this is the kind of team I'd like to play on because, you know, every night if you're in the starting five, those four other guys are going to be guys that are going to bust their tail to win the game as opposed to a guy on a team that maybe, you know, New Mexico is down this year and a starter who's been there 3 years, he's getting his 25 minutes. He might just mail it in on a certain given night. I want to play with guys who know that they're playing for a chance to be a starter every game. I think for a team that maybe isn't as talented as we expect from Mexico, this is the perfect way to go about it because guys are competing every night as opposed to just, I've been here 3 years, I'm going to ship it in, shoot my 10 shots, get 20 points, we'll lose by 10, it'll be fine, I'll go on, start the next game, end my career.
I get what he's doing. Like, it is establishing some kind of culture. It's establishing the identity of the team, what you want it to be. And there's some value in that. I get it. I just don't know if that's the best way. And maybe, again, it's not about this year. And it's not about maximizing their ceiling for what they can accomplish in the 2018 Mountain West schedule. But I've seen a lot of basketball. I'm sure, you know, Coach Weir has seen a lot of basketball. I don't know if that I've never seen that being done. I've seen lineups change based on, like, analytical things like matchups, lineup combinations that you want to see together. You think this shooter needs to be paired with this ball handler. You think this big matches up with their bigs better. Like, I've seen that be reasons why you change your lineup in a game-in, game-out basis. But, like, for example, Coach Presnell, one of the things that I think is a value of Boise State for women's basketball is that very frequently Boise State has the fewest number of starting lineups than basically everybody else in the league. Barring injury, Coach Presnell rarely changes the starting lineup. And I think that does play a factor in the fact that Boise State's won two of the last three Mountain West tournaments, is by the time they get to March, they are playing at a level, continuity, that is better than a lot of the other teams that have shifted their lineups back and forth. So we'll see what happens tonight. And if New Mexico goes out and wins the game, I'm sure it'll be a little bit more praise for their coaching staff for designing this way to have a starting lineup. Thanks to Bob, who joined us for the first hour and a half of the show. Fish back in the studio. I'm from Albuquerque. Be sure to listen to Boise State, whether it's men's or women's basketball, tonight on Sports Radio, The Ticket. I know Sports Talk next.
Sports Radio 93.1 FM and 1350 AM, The Ticket.